On New Year's Eve, 1950, a group of artists gathered at a decaying walk-up apartment on East 8th Street in New York City to drink and dance. The party lasted 3 days, but the influence of some of the people who attended that party still survives. Willem de Kooning, for example. When the Dutch-born painter died in 1997, he was remembered as the first modern art star. His work hangs in major museums, sells for millions of dollars, and is still discussed and debated, as are the facts of his life. The story of that 1950 New Year's Eve party is told in a new biography of Willem de Kooning. Mark Stevens and Annalyn Swan are the co-authors of De Kooning, An American Master, and they're in the studio. Welcome, Mark.
Welcome. Thank you.
And welcome, Annalyn.
Thank you.
Willem de Kooning was 45 years old, had lived in New York City through the Depression, and had just had his first one-man show in 1948. What happened to the art world in America in the 1950s, and why was Willem de Kooning considered the emblem of that era? Mark, let me start with you.
Well, first of all, artists in the late 40s, American artists, began to create a new kind of pulsing space and all over field, a very exciting new kind of painting that attracted attention in the mainstream culture for the first time. These artists who were very poor, very ignored, very unloved really in America suddenly found themselves being looked at, being watched for the first time. And some very rather unusual people already in their 40s and 50s who had known no success were suddenly willy-nilly becoming public figures.
He also, though, had these matinee good looks, and it was at a time where America itself was becoming more modern, and it was a time, you write, where people stopped talking about art and started talking about personalities, and de Kooning, indeed, was a personality.
Well, the roots of our current celebrity culture, especially in the art world, lie in the 1950s. That's when it began to happen. And the art world wanted a star, was looking for a star. Jackson Pollock was certainly the first, but he was in a desperate condition in the early 50s. He was a terrible alcoholic. He was very self-destructive, and he was a very shy man who was really unwilling to play easily or comfortably the role of the star. De Kooning, too, was quite reluctant to be a star, but he was so good-looking, he was so appealing, he had this kind of broken Dutch-accented English that that people found entrancing. He was the person who the culture began to settle upon as the representative of a new powerful strain of American art.
We have to talk about his why he was loved so much by poets, and to a certain extent it was because of the way that he talked. He loved American slang. And so his language was almost made up. I mean, an example, I just remember, he used to call himself, I'm a country dumpling.
From the minute he hit America, he refused to speak Dutch anymore. And as a result, he went into this sort of fractured, you know, Dutch English, which he spoke for the rest of his life. And the artist Saul Steinberg just loved the way de Kooning talked, because he talked in this sort of marvelous malaprops that he would come out with. And one of our favorites is he would say, if he needed a thin suit, he'd say, I need a tin suit. Or he would say, how do you paint? You pick up a brush and you have fate instead of faith. So things would come out sort of sideways, or he would say, I'm going to take a schnoos. And a schnoos was both a snooze, which is a nap, but it was also a schnoos was, you know, in Dutch, a prostitute. So he was always playing with the language in these marvelously fanciful ways.
Well, and people were never quite sure, especially the poets, whether he meant it or not. Did he mean to make that pun? Did he mean to make that sort of marvelous existential reference? One time he said, in the beginning was the void. The void as an existential, you know, philosophy? Or was he saying in the beginning was the word?
Right. Talk a little bit about his technique and his art, what is called his gift. What was his gift?
Well, his gift to begin with was draftsmanship. He was one of the great hands of the 20th century. And by that, I don't just mean that he could draw a beautiful line. He also had a kind of touch. And if you look at the way he handles paint, There's so much poetry and emotion and contrary feeling always in his brushstroke. So he was immediately attractive. Clement Greenberg said he took a whole generation with him, and that's because his hand was so seductive.
It's what we call the bravura brushstroke, you know. And other artists talked about the whiplash de Kooning line and said he had the fastest paintbrush in the West.
He was also his work. It looked very energetic, and yet you could stop in front of it and think as well.
Well, that's certainly true of all the decades of de Kooning's work. One thing that permeates the book is how changeable de Kooning was, and he never settled into a style. He reinvented himself constantly. One of his favorite sayings was, "You have to change to stay the same." And he would grow bored working within whatever style he was of the moment. So he constantly reinvented himself throughout his entire life until up through the 80s.
In fact, that story you mentioned about the New Year's party, a few months after that, he would make one of the great works of the 20th century called Excavation in the spring of 1950. However, he threw that style away. That style, that black and white style, which culminated in Excavation, could have stood him for the rest of his life. He could have done variations on it. It was a blue chip style. He could have made his life a lot more comfortable. Instead, having made the masterpiece of that particular period of his art, he just chucked it away. He actually made a little door in the painting, and he said, "I went through that door and I never came back."
Let's talk about a remarkable piece of his. It's called Woman One. You call this painting, there's nothing else like it in American art. The images remain disturbing. It's one of the most difficult pictures in the American canon to fix with meaning. Could I get you, because this is radio, to describe the painting that we're talking about, Mark?
Well, the picture, first of all, it took de Kooning almost 3 years to paint. He changed it constantly. It went through literally hundreds of versions. It became a kind of tormenting mirror, mirror upon the wall for him. It is a picture of, in part, an idol, an ancient idol. He said he had seen a Mexican goddess to whom hearts were sacrificed, and this appealed to him. But it's also a very contemporary picture. It's a picture of a Hollywood starlet, perhaps. It's many things at once. It's perhaps his mother. Many people say he had a very tough mother, so this is a ferocious mother. It's also a picture of a painter struggling to portray a woman. You know, he said that he always insisted upon the hilarity of it as well, the hilariousness. To him, this was funny. Annalyn, as a woman, has a particular reaction to this picture, I know, and likes that he thought it was funny as well as everything
else.
Yeah,
he thought this was funny?
Well, that was one of the essential things about de Kooning, that he, along the way, got criticized for being a misogynist. But, you know, he really never was. Of course, with de Kooning, anything you say, there's something contradictory. He was a man of great complexity. But beginning with the late 30s, when he met Elaine de Kooning, his wife, he took the woman as his great muse. And as Mark said, he always insisted upon the hilarity of even Woman One, the comic side. Years later, he said she even frightened him, and he was sort of wondered where she came from. But he also pointed out that the funniness of it. I mean, she's got boobs. She's a girl who could have come off a pinup or a sign by a highway, except she's also ferocious.
His work ethic was amazing. He was always working up until about 1990, when his Alzheimer's disease really began to prevent that. Do the periods of his art, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, do they have the same value? I mean, he's someone, you write, he had a life of many, many acts, but is there a great period?
This is something that's still argued about with some intensity in the art world. Almost everyone agrees that the paintings of the late 40s, the black and whites and Excavation, are magisterial works. Some critics subsequently have a problem is when de Kooning, as in Woman One, becomes more difficult, when he declares that he does not want to make a very tasteful resolve painting, when he wants to push the envelope. I've come to admire greatly that aspect of de Kooning. You know, there's a Flemish Low Country, a sort of too muchness, a feeling for the grotesque. He once said, beauty makes me feel petulant. I prefer the grotesque. It's more joyous.
But one of my favorite periods, one of the reasons that I was drawn personally, because we began talking about why we did de Kooning, were these great, lush, gorgeous pastoral paintings that he did beginning in the mid-1970s, when he used, his medium was safflower oil and water, and it had created this sort of bubbly, thick, viscous texture. And when you actually see one of these paintings, you know, it sort of knocks your socks off because it's so visceral and so immediate.
He broke all the rules of the avant-garde as well as of the bourgeoisie. You know, he wanted to break any rule that he could find. That way he could stay free, could stay loose, could stay a slipping glimpser.
Mark Stevens and Annalyn Swan are the co-authors of De Kooning, An American Master, published by Knopf. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
Annalyn, thank you.
Thank you.
Works from De Kooning, An American Master, can be seen on our website. It includes Woman One. Our website address is npr.org. This is Weekend Edition, directed by Elaine Heinzman, with production help from Ned Wharton, David Rector, Jesse Baker, and Emily Oxenschlager. Stu Seidel is the senior editor. The senior producer is Robert Maleski. Our technical director today is Kim Jones, with audio engineer Greg Gavin. NPR's ombudsman is Jeffrey Dvorkin. Our reference librarian is Key Maleski. Our theme music was written by B.J. Lederman, with additional music from Steph Skajari and Greg Smith. I'm Leanne Hansen.